Listener emails on episode 416 of the Actual Astronomy Podcast. I'm Chris, and joining me is Shane. We are amateur astronomers who love looking up the night sky, and this podcast is for everybody who likes going out under the stars. So, how was your past 5 minutes, Shane?
Lovely, thank you.
Excellent, excellent. Yes, refresh the water, ready to go. I didn't really put too much of an intro into this, but I was saying that I haven't been as good at email recently. We took, kind of like a couple weeks off there, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of, sort of.
Yeah, we were able to take the Easter weekend off, and as such, we focus on other things.
Yeah. So it kind of ends up being like a couple weeks off from the podcast, and we hadn't been getting as much email. And so, and that's fine, of course. And then I kind of get out of the habit of replying and, yeah, working away at the old day job.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. So not podcasting full time. At our current rate, though, I predict that in 325 years, we'll be able to make a living off this.
Can't wait.
Not accounting for inflation, of course.
I'll start altering my retirement plans.
Exactly. Exactly. Freedom 435. Yeah.
Well, you have to have a dream.
Yes. This is living the dream. Yes. I just hope we are done with the snow and the really, really cold weather. It's hard to believe. Yeah. A week ago when we recorded, it was minus 21 with the wind chill. And now today it's a very balmy 10 degrees out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Come hopefully on. This is the beginning of spring for us.
Yes, and not the beginning of the end with wildfire season. I heard they've canceled some sort of event up in Yellowknife because they anticipate fire being such a concern this year that, some events are getting canceled already, which is pretty wild if you think about it.
Yeah, for sure.
I don't know how it could be any worse than last year. So, because I think it was like five or six times worse than the next worst year or something. It was just so bad. We had smoke so much of the time. It was too bad. So yeah, if we do get smoke, maybe that's when I'll go on a trip to observe and escape the smoke.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good way to do it.
So Michael Wright wrote us an email. Maybe I'll read this one. So Michael wrote, sure. Hi guys. I was listening to the most recent episode while I was driving out to Hackbart Hill observing site near Cross Hill, Ontario, a place where I have personally, that's me, Chris talking, observed a whole pile of times because that place was only like 15 minutes from my house or apartment that I had there. Michael goes on to say, I do not want to start working my way through the RASC double star list, but I have other objects on the go right now. Eventually I stumbled across the Winter Albireo though. A few weeks ago while hunting down the Tau Canis Majoris cluster. It's a beautiful double for sure. I really like that Tau Canis Majoris cluster. Remember the first time I saw it's like 223 something something. Anyway, it's visible in Mike's 15 by 50s. I know that because that's what I first saw it in. I have my 20 by 60s out that night too. It's a nice tight cluster around the star Tau Canis Majoris, of course. Mike goes on to say, tonight my goal was to see Comet 12P Pons Brooks and maybe a few galaxies as well. The comet was really nice. I saw a couple wedges of not so bright areas in the coma. They were fleeting but kept coming back, so I convinced myself they were a real feature. Once twilight had faded and the comet started to get low, I turned to Hydra with the intent on hunting down a couple other items. I was looking for NGC 2974, but stumbled across the field where the faint planetary nebula Abel 33 is located, and I decided to take a deep look to see if I could make it out. It is right next to a seventh magnitude star, so it was a bit of a challenge. With a UHC filter, I could do it, but I had to bump up the power to 150x before I felt reasonably confident that I was able to see it due to the contrast boost. It is a fairly large, faint, and circular object. I thought the edge had just the barest hint of brightness over the interior, but it was mostly just a faint, dull, full, flat glow over the whole thing. I could not see a central stellar remnant. I did hunt down NGC 2974 afterwards. It was one of those galaxies that will give a little more with patience. It is right next to a 10th magnitude star and at first appears as a fuzzy extension of it. But with higher magnification and inverted vision, the stellar nucleus and inner disk became prominent while the ellipse inflates. My next target was NGC 2776 in Lynx, near the forepaw of Ursa Major. This was a real treat, a face-on spiral where I could make out some structure with patience and averted vision. I spent some time with this one and made a sketch of it. He included the sketches. Thanks so much. And sketches of 12P as well. I would like to come back to this one at a darker site. I was struggling a bit with things, though, because it was on the edge of the daub hole and it was getting hard to keep things centered. The next couple targets I wanted to try for were getting frustrating, so I gave up, moved south into Leo Minor, had a brief look at NGC 2859, a curious galaxy with a bright nucleus and two prominent knots at the ends of a bar. There is some space between the disk and a very, very tenuous halo. Another one to visit somewhere with darker skies. I have attached some pics of my field sketches. Hope you are getting a chance to view the comet too. Ellen tells me it might be naked eye during the eclipse, so people should watch for that as well. Michael, thanks for that, Michael.
Yeah, those are some really good observations.
Yeah, I like those sketches. Those are pretty nice, really great sketch of 12P Pons Brooks with lots of detail there. So I appreciate you sending that through. Michael's observing with a 12-inch Dobsonian. I can't remember whether that was in the early part of the notes or not. So that's his tool of choice.
Yeah, yeah. He gets a lot of use out of that 12-inch and really does some really nice observing. Always enjoy hearing Michael's observing reports.
And from what I'm recalling, he lives like in a big apartment. So it's not that easy for him to get telescope from where it lives to his car. He has to kind of do a pile of trips in that. So so it's good on him for keeping that up.
Yeah, yeah.
Enrique sent us an email here. Shane, there's actually two. Maybe I'll get you to read the first maybe read the title. You were enjoying the title as well.
Yeah, yeah. The subject line was "Greetings from a Lost Mexican Observer." And Enrique says, "Hello, guys. I really enjoy listening to your podcast, but apparently I am not a good listener. I've been so much into astrophotography and astronomy-oriented research, photometry and spectroscopy. Yeah, there you go. That I forgot how much fun is the visual astronomy. Just recently in our club, we purchased an 8-inch Dobsonian for this purpose. While our scopes are busy taking pictures or science, we want to observe the night sky. Is it possible for you to suggest a couple of books so that we can get right into the fun of visual astronomy? We all know Messier objects and even the Herschel catalog, but I know because you have discussed that previously that you also follow catalogs or something similar focused on double stars, odd clusters, and objects that could be difficult to observe. Any information about this will be most appreciated." So that's that. Really want to encourage you to continue with the podcast. It is indeed really fun to listen to. From Enrique.
Very cool.
So this is definitely in your spectrum when it comes to books. I certainly have some and I enjoy some, but you have the most extensive astronomy library that I know of. So
yeah, so it's very simple recommendation. We've made it many times in the show, but is the Stephen O'Meara Deep Sky Companions. Like, I think if you're just looking to kind of have books that provide you with lots of observations, details on the targets, I think those are really the core set. I really can't think of anything much better to recommend. I mean, there's sort of countless astronomy books out there, but as far as like a pretty consistent library talking about deep sky observing and that sort of thing, I don't know what else. There's the Sue French Deep Sky Wonders, which is basically a compendium, an amalgamation, a synthesis of many of her articles from Sky and Telescope magazine over the years. Then, of course, there is Sky and Telescope magazine. Yeah, but it's sort of strangely enough, there's not that many observing books. I guess if you want to take a look, my favorite one, of course, is The Deep Sky Wonders by, it's now escaping me, but there's
Walter
another deep.
Scott.
Walter Scott Houston, yeah, that's right, which was edited together by Stephen O'Meara. So it gets a little bit confusing because you have all these names that are kind of jumbled in together. And that's more of a narrative on amateur astronomy sort of through the years. I quite enjoy reading that one as well. But yeah, there's not too much. I really wish, like, you know, and Howard will probably write if I put this on, but I do really wish that Howard or you know, one of the other editors at Sky and Telescope would put something together, because there's been some incredible articles by folks over the years. I have accordion file folders of them here, because often I buy the magazines and then you know, I don't want to keep the whole magazine kicking around, but I'll cut out like a Mel Bartels or Alan Whitman or one of Howard's articles. I mean, you know, the list goes on. There's Steve Gottlieb, and you know, there's probably half a dozen or a dozen people that write articles in there on a fairly consistent basis. There's almost always something from one of them in there, and it would make a really interesting book at some point in time or something. I don't know what. It's difficult these days because while we still have, you know, Sky and Telescope and astronomy magazines and others, and we still have astronomy books, I don't know what the market is like for this type of material. So it's it's kind of, because I find it's difficult to navigate, like my accordion binder. Like, I do go and grab them once in a while, but it's not really that convenient to have them in there either. It would be nice if they were just sort of in a text. Phil Harrington put a nice book out on challenge objects. I think it's just called The Challenge Objects or something. That's a pretty good book as well. Let's see. He goes on to say, because we had some back and forth, and I had some questions, because, you know, and I'm sure we do have other listeners from Mexico as well, but I was just curious about a few things. So I wrote him, gave some of this advice, and then about books and such, and then asked a whole pile of questions. So Enrique goes on to say, thanks for your super prompt reply. So this is like one of the days where I was replying to email, and then I was just like, oh, okay, that's good. At least it gives the illusion that I'm replying with some cadence. He goes on to say, I have recommended your podcast to several colleagues, so I believe that you guys must already have a small audience in Mexico. Of course, Stephen O'Meara's books. Totally forgot about them. Thanks for reminding me. They are going to add to our small emergent library. Now for your questions. The name of our club is COMETA, COMETA, which is an acronym we call ourselves. The Club de Observatorios Mexico Telescopios Astronomía. Our club, however, is very young. And I've probably said that totally, like, I'm sure I butchered that quite badly, but I've said it. Our club, however, is very young. We only have about three members, and they've been going for about 4 months. But yeah, good on you folks for getting that going. That's awesome. We are in the progress of putting up a Facebook page and trying to get more members to the club. We have great ideas to spread the astronomy word out there, one of them being taken the Dobsonian and the C-Star to public spaces like parks, squares, schools, etc., and share some of the night sky with people like Jupiter Joe does in New York City. So I'm not that. Are you familiar with Jupiter Joe? I wasn't that familiar with
that. No, I've never heard of that. So,
yeah, I guess. Like, well, there's people all over that like take telescopes all over the place and show people the night sky. That's pretty cool. Enrique goes on to say about the darkness, because I wanted to know about the darkness of skies in Mexico, something I was just curious about. Well, around central Mexico, there are not too many. We do have three places we tend to go at least once a month that are about 2 hours away from us. Three of them are Bortle 4, and they are located in our city's neighbor state. And that's Estado de Mexico, which is about 2.5 hours away. And in the not so close Hidalgo, which is 3 hours drive, and Guanajuato, 3.5 hours away. I'm not even going to try to keep pronouncing things, maybe. However, we do make some astrophotography and astronomical CMOS observations, spectroscopy, photometry from our homes in Mexico City. Because I think Mexico City has like, and I think it's like 25 million people or something. So there's a lot of people there. Anyway, millions of people. Most of the photography we do is narrowband, but sometimes we furiously attempt broadband objects that are located in sky spots that seem to have less light pollution. Fortunately, the science side can be done, even from our light polluted places. I have a permanent observatory, in brackets, on my roof, actually with a SkyWatcher EQ6-R Pro equipped with a ED80. And a SkyWatcher 130 PDS and a mini RASA, which is actually a Rokinon 135 millimeter f/2 lens. I say observatory because I only put a Telegizmo's cover on it and don't have a roll off or dome or anything like that. The only difference of doing astronomy in Mexico might be the locations we choose. Sometimes for special trips, we tend to go to archaeological sites and take with us an archaeoastronomer. This is pretty cool. So yeah. He shares his knowledge about astronomy in ancient pre-Hispanic civilizations such as Maya, Olmeca, etc. I know this is a big, interesting difference. This is really cool. This is like what I was wondering, like what are the cultural differences of doing astronomy in different places in the world. So I thought I would just sort of ask the question since he and I were having a friendly conversation. And so I really appreciate that. Otherwise, we learned from you guys, Trevor Jones, Chuck Ayoub, and Dylan O'Donnell. And of course, we also follow Dr. Becky, Brian Keating, Brian Cox, Brian Green, etc. Plans we have for this year, besides trying to catch the eclipse on Monday. Best of luck to you folks who link Mexico and down where they are is a little bit better, are to go to San Pedro Martir, and that's in Baja. And it turns out the most important optical telescope in Mexico is located there, and there is a nearby place in which you can stay and enjoy Border One skies. That sounds pretty good. Maybe I will go to Mexico after all. That sounds like fun. Thank you very much for your interest. Chris, say hi to Shane on my behalf. Well, there you go. Clear skies. Enrique.
Yeah, thanks for writing, Enrique. Always enjoy hearing about astronomy, particularly in different cultures. And I would love to know more, too, about, or maybe if he's got any books he could recommend around some of that archaeoastronomy and just how the pre-Hispanic civilizations viewed the night sky. I would certainly be interested in that.
Yeah, that's interesting. I was watching it was an anime, which I'm really not that into anime, but I just put it on one day. It had, like the guy from Better Call Saul and Breaking Bad in it. Anyway, I'm not like a huge fan. I can't remember the actor's name, but anyway, it had a few actors and actresses. I think one of them is originally from Canada, but is Hispanic, I believe. Anyway, And they created this really interesting anime, but it included some of this. But anyways, it was a fascinating show. I wish I could remember what it was off the top of my head. But they had some of this in there where they went to like an archaeological site and there was like this cosmological tie-in. It was pretty cool. Anyway, I should have looked that up before I just started freewheeling on it. But pretty cool stuff that's out there. And I would like to learn more about that as well. Larry wrote us. Shane, do you want to take this one away?
Sure. So, hey, Chris and Shane, this is Larry from Japan again. Been busy with work and family stuff, so just got caught up on some episodes. Wanted to send some observations on Shane's double star observations from episode 411. First, about Beta Minoceris. I observed this triple a few weeks ago on a nice clear night here. I was using my 80 ED F7 and was able to split in very easily. It was just a casual observation, so I didn't keep notes, but I'm pretty sure that I was able to split the third star at about 110 to 120 power. I definitely did not have to go up to 163 like Shane did. Anyways, my point was to let Shane know that you can definitely split the star with a smaller aperture. Shouldn't be any problem with your TAC 76. Yeah, that night that I was observing that, the seeing was pretty poor. Maybe that contributed a little bit to me needing more power, but regardless, it's a beautiful double star system, which is actually a triple star system, but highly recommend it. Back to Larry's email, he says, second, Shane made a comment about focal and color, which I think I said, that I feel like the longer the focal length, the more color seems to stand out for me, like star color. And Larry says that I would agree with you that a longer focal length seems to show a deeper or richer color. I've done almost all of my double star observing with either an 80 millimeter F11 Achromat or an 80 millimeter ED F7. The ED scope can definitely make tighter splits, but I feel the color is better in the F11. Maybe it's just the difference in glass, acro versus apo, but I wanted to let Shane know that it's not just him. So thanks, Larry. I appreciate that. By the way, speaking of Betamonoceros, there is a good article on or in Sky and Telescope about winter triple stars. In case you haven't seen it, here is the link, and he's included that in the email. And then finally, Chris mentioned wanting some colorful doubles to sketch. So I thought I would add a few suggestions from my observations. Apologies, I don't have the RA and declination for these. So the first one here is not four in Puppis. It's wide with two orange stars. The next one here is in Taurus, Tau 1 Hydrae, somewhat wide, yellow, red, and pink. Pink is an interesting color. Mm. And then I don't know how to pronounce this next one here in Leonis.
Algeba.
Tight yellow. So there you go, Chris. Some colorful doubles to check out. And then Larry says, okay, got to get back to work. Thanks as always for the great episodes and clear skies.
Yeah, work. Thanks for that, Larry. Yeah, work has been kind of one of those things on my end too. Thanks for those double stars. We'll hopefully get to try to check some of those out if we get some clear skies soon. Fingers crossed. I don't know. It's not looking amazing here, is it? Like now that we're warmed up, of course. We had all this nice clear weather when it was like minus 20s, but now not as much.
Yeah, exactly. Hopefully it shapens up for new moon.
I looked up the animation because like I'm not like huge in animation, but if something is good, like I'll watch it. So this one is called Undone. And I think if somebody... you don't have to be into animation to like this. And the reviews are spectacular of it with Bob Odenkirk. Sorry, that's his name. But has a variety of interesting actors. And it's just an interesting show. It has like sort of some, you know, it's a bit strange, but it's very, very cool. It's a bit about like interdimensional time. It's like fiction, but it's very entertaining. Very well done, but they have some of this sort of visiting archaeological sites and cosmology and that sort of thing. And anyway, what Enrique was talking about kind of in a certain way reminding me of that. But that's just a cool show. If somebody wants to see a really, really neat animation show, and it's created using a technique called rotoscoping, live action motion capture and rotoscoping. So I don't know if that has to do with the roto pens I was looking at. Probably not. I have no idea what I'm talking about. I'm going to go back to the emails.
Good idea.
Chris wrote us, funny coincidence. I just started the RASC double star list and was doing several of the winter stars that Shane reported on. Mm-hmm. I have found that Blake created this list about a dozen or so years ago. I was the observing chair president when Blake approached me with it, and I gave Blake all kinds of feedback. Some of it was good. Some of it probably wasn't the best, but Blake took my comments in stride. I think typically most people just have ignored me, probably rightfully so, but he actually really dug in and we kind of went back and forth on some of this, and he really went sort of back and kind of went through it. And I think that's one of the reasons why it's so good. It's just the type of observer Blake was and just that revisiting of it too. Like I think a lot of the times when people think about making up a list, I think when we're making our own list just to go observing, that's one thing, Shane. Mm-hmm. That's one thing. And that's great. So we can go out, but you make the observations and then it's like that rehashing of it, like that filtration, that synthesis, that analysis of your observations, and then going back and doing that reobserving of those things and mm-hmm. kind of looking for the interesting that's around them. And I think that's where Blake really excelled. And he was awesome at doing that. And it was amazing that he did it, because I think a lot of the time, especially with all of us, we're just volunteers or having fun. And like in the case of this podcast, doing it, I think a lot of the time we're like, I'm done with it. I know I certainly am like that. I'm like, I'm done with that thing. I'm just going to write it and get on to my next thing. But Blake did go back and have another look at it. And I think that the way that he thought and the way that he did things just really brought out like some interesting stuff in that list, which I have and did at the time a little observing of. Chris goes on to say, I found that Blake was clever and in some cases almost diabolical in his selection of targets. And you know what? Like,
I would agree.
And I knew Blake really well, and that is like an absolute 100% fair assessment. Blake put his personality into that list, and I think that that really made it something.
Mm-hmm.
Chris goes on to say he certainly left all amateur astronomers an enduring and excellent legacy with this list, and I totally agree with that. It's a fun list. I haven't observed everything on the list, but I keep pulling out like half a dozen stars or so a year. I'll go and look, and I can't remember which ones they are. And I know other people have like pointed me at some of them, and it's just in general. I think like every target, there's something with every target. So Chris goes on to say a good example is HD34071 and Lepus, a close faint pair that was hard for me to find. Fortunately, using a 25 millimeter at 26X, I found them. And it's in the upper left quadrant of the field, while the much brighter Mu Leporis is just inside the field at about the 6 o'clock position. On a lighter note, he set up 83 Leo and Tau Leo that appear within the same field of a 25 millimeter eyepiece, which is certainly convenient. Yeah, it's pretty amazing what's in that list. Yeah, I spot checked it for him. I didn't look at everything, and then other people did as well. And we had a lot of comments and critiques on the first list, and then he kind of gave it back, took it back, and then did a redo of it. And then when it came back out, it was essentially perfect, sort of in Blake's style. So it's pretty awesome. Chris goes on to say, but we can still he can still be really challenging with the fainter constellations where the target is well away from the prominent stars. This is particularly the case with Lynx and Camelopardalis. Oddly, another problem is when the target is in a rich field, for example, Phi Taurus, where you have to wonder which of the several apparent doubles is the one you want. I suspect that when we get into the summer Milky Way fields of the Milky Way, it'll be even more so. Like Shane, I am observing in heavily light-polluted skies. I find it really difficult to be sure I have the right target. The technique I'm using is to scan in general with 8x42 binoculars, figuring out the basic structure of the constellation, then finding a reasonably prominent star and star hopping via finder scope along the pattern observed in the binos. I shift to the 25 millimeter in the telescope to get a basic sense of the field, then usually move to the 10 millimeter 65X for the actual observation. I also use a laptop with Stellarium to compare what I'm seeing in the eyepiece to what the software says I should be seeing. Because I am observing from the deck in the winter, I can't get the bead on Polaris as the house is in the way. So using even mechanical setting circles to get in the general vicinity isn't an option. Perhaps as the yard dries out, things will be better. I must say that I am really enjoying the double star program. It's a great way to build familiarity with some of the less known corners of the sky. I highly recommend it to anyone else who is into visual observing, and I look forward to vicariously comparing notes with Shane via the podcast.
Love it. Love to hear about all of this double star observing. It's just easy. You can do it from your backyard, regardless of light pollution. And B, it's fun. It tests a little bit of your observing skills, and especially when you're splitting some real close ones. And then the last part is they're quite pretty, and Blake's list is awesome. So highly recommend that. Great to hear that lots of people are using it.
Mm-hmm.
And like, really, there's an endless amount of doubles up there. So even once you get beyond Blake's list, there's the Cambridge Double Star Atlas, which has another list in there. There's certainly some crossover with Blake's. But I think I think the Astronomy League maybe has a double star list. So there's lots of different ones out there. And the neat thing with double stars is, if you have like planetarium software or planning software, you can often create your own list just based on separation that would challenge or be on the limit of whatever aperture you're using, and mm-hmm. Just have an endless amount of doubles to look at in the backyard. So mm-hmm. Love to hear it.
Yeah. Cool. Anything else to add to the show, Shane?
No, that's it, Chris.
Well, thanks for listening, everybody. Please subscribe, share the show with other stargazers, and send us your ideas, observations, and questions to actualastronomy@gmail.com.
Thank you, everyone, for listening, and we hope you enjoyed the show. If you are interested in more information, would like to contact us, or if you would like to support the podcast, check out our website, actualastronomy.com.